Welcome to the Pendulum Insight Podcast. This is a show for deal makers in the blockchain business, where we meet the players who are changing the game today and get their insight into everything from the red tape to the raise. This is your host, Colton Moffitt. Let's get started. Hey, everybody. We're joined here today by Alvaro Jimenez from Gaudium Capital. And we were introduced by a mutual connection, Jeremy Bush at LootSafe. So, you know, it's been a real pleasure getting to know Alvaro. So why don't you tell us about yourself a little bit so that everybody who's listening knows more about who you are and why you got into the blockchain economy?
Yeah, thank you very much, Colton. Thank you for having me here today. I very much appreciate it. So basically, you know, in short, I got into the blockchain economy because I believe it's one of those key technologies that it is really going to shape the future. To give you a clear example, just so it's not my own opinion, I was last week in an investment forum in United Arab Emirates, and every single speaker, ranging from government officials to industry experts, they all agreed that the engines that are gonna enable the next revolution and, you know, the best economies that we're gonna see in the next 10 years are gonna be focused on artificial intelligence, blockchain, robotization and automation, biotech and healthcare, together with a very, very strong base of education to foster the human capital. So blockchain is one of those. I personally think the combination of blockchain with artificial intelligence, we're yet to see the amazing things that can be produced. I'll be happy to give a couple of examples here, but just to keep the intro short, that's why I went into blockchain. Now, Gaudium Capital, its focus on all of the deep tech areas is not only focused on blockchain. We also touch AI, we also touch robotization, automation, so software as a service, any sort of cutting edge technology we like to work with. As far as myself, to give you a little bit of background, my background is mostly in investments, economics, and finance. So I spent some early years in banking. Then, you know, when my career was a little bit more mature, I moved to private equity. Then from private equity, I moved to be a finance manager in Microsoft. Then from Microsoft, I transitioned to a venture capital firm that specialized in blockchain. And we had a portfolio of 40 companies around the globe. And from there on, I decided to move on my own. And I started Gaudium Capital as the opportunity came. And it's a very early days. It's a very boutique investment and advisory firm. The firms that we advise, they need to go through a pretty deep, thorough, you know, thresholds, you know, because we want them to succeed, but we want to succeed too, and we want to create a reputation that is good for everyone. So we like to work with highly qualified teams of people that are in the cutting edge technologies. We have an international vision, so we work with pretty much any company that fits the profile anywhere in the world. It can be in the US, it can be in Australia, it can be in Europe, it can be in Africa. We don't care. Like, we are geography agnostic. For us, the most important thing is it's people. We have the conviction, as you can read in our website, that life is all about people. Business, it's all about people. Consequently, we put people always first, and that's our main target. And then, just, you know, for the sake of the ongoing conversation, because probably we're going to talk a little bit about investments.
Yes.
Markets, STOs, and things like that. I mean, I just anticipating what can come up. I want to make sure that I come clean with a legal disclaimer and say that nothing that we are going to say here, it's financial advice or legal advice. Everyone should do their own due diligence and everyone should take care of their own finances. We're not seeking investment from anyone through this conversation here. If someone is interested, they can follow protocol through our website.
Sure. I appreciate that. You know, this focus on people and the integrity that goes with that is obviously a good thing. And you'd think it would be standard for everybody, but it's actually nice and rare to find. So you mentioned that you're focus on people. And mm-hmm. I also found that the name Gaudium is an interesting one. So why don't you tell us about that really briefly as we tie up this intro and move forward?
Yeah, absolutely. So we wanted to come up with a name that would have some deep meaning. And Gaudium is an ancient Latin word that means joy and delight. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, we're spent some days in this life, we all want to try to make the most out of it. So if we can bring some joy and delight to it, the better.
All right, then. That's good to know. So, we were connected by somebody that we've both had good conversations with, Jeremy Bush at Loot Safe. And he's a really nice guy, very bright. So he told me that you were working as an advisor, strategic advisor for Loot Safe, and that you were looking at different kinds of projects in not just blockchain, but also kind of fintech and AI, as you said earlier. So how did you come to be involved with Loot Safe and how did that relationship develop?
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, a shout out to Jeremy, who's doing amazing work for Loot Safe in Asia. Very much appreciate, like I said before, it's all about people. So I very much appreciate working with people such as Jeremy. Mm-hmm. The way that we go about it again is we filter every single company that might want advisory services from Gaudium Capital. And so we filter even more the companies that Gaudium Capital is going to invest in. So Loot Safe perfectly fit the bill for both. It's a fantastic team of people with extremely high ethics. Not only that, but they are super, super technical. And they're very, very good at what they do. And here, the key value proposition of Loot Safe is that they can shape the future of gaming by providing the necessary infrastructure for what will become gaming 2.0. Mm-hmm. To give you a very quick example of what the Loot Safe technology enables. So right now, players struggle a lot with spending a lot of time and a lot of money in items that they don't even own. Right. And then, that some scandals happen here and there, like we know with certain big games that we're not going to mention. And then all of that time and money invested goes to nothing, which is extremely frustrating. With Loot Safe technology, the gamers own every single item that they have on their games. Not only that, but they can transfer those items across games, across platforms, and across servers. And they own that. So consequently, they can do whatever they want with that. They can store it, they can sell them, they can trade them, they can do anything they want. For publishers, it's also very appealing because not only are you providing that to gamers, but also you can enable to transfer them from mobile to desktop, from desktop to console, and from console to something else. You also are not limited by servers. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, you can implement game economies without the need of the gamers to leave the game. So they can continue playing while they transfer their items, they store their items, or whatever they want to do with those items.
Right.
So we have found that very appealing too. And, I think it's going to be a technology that shapes the future of gaming as we know it. The games that are currently implementing Loot Safe, they're very satisfied with it. It's super easy to implement, as easy as an API.
Yeah.
And that's how everything came about. If you allow me, I would also like to mention another project that Gaudium is working with, just so the audience gets a better idea
Sure,
of the kind of thank you. So the kind of profile that we like to work with. It happens to be also a blockchain project, but this one targets the industry of employment. Mm-hmm. So as of today, you know, you and I have been through it. Everyone has been through it. Everyone who has been employed. Getting and becoming employed is a pain in the neck, not only because of the process of finding employment, but also because of the process of getting onboarded into someone else's database or someone else's system.
Right.
It takes an average of 33 days in the US to onboard a retail employee. That is background checks, history check, verifications, and so on and so forth. Mm. Well, all of that with the infrastructure that Emparta provides, all of that is gone and reduced to the push of a button. So employer meets employee. If they like each other, they push a button and all of the information necessary is transferred and integrated, you know, for the employer. So the benefits are astonishing. And we are also seeing a lot of traction because employment as we know it today, it cannot continue to be like that. It's too cumbersome. It needs to change. It needs to evolve. So these are the kind of companies that we like to work with, the ones that have a vision of how an industry is going to look like in the future and can provide the infrastructure and the game changers to enable that.
Right. Okay. That's definitely interesting. And, you know, we had a conversation a little while ago, and you'd mentioned that focus on something that's really going to change how things are done in industry. They've got a vision for how it's done. And specifically those that are coming from an infrastructure perspective. So rather than something that's merely transactional or kind of a layer on top of something else where it's augmenting it, you're looking at core infrastructure plays. So was that a decision that just comes from needing to allocate your resources that are limited as effectively as possible for maximum benefit? Or was that a profit motivation purely where you're looking and it's like, hey, look, this is going to be what makes us the most money over time? Or is it some combination?
Yeah, no, I think you're spot on, Colton. The reason to focus on infrastructure is all of the reasons that you have mentioned above. So first of all, when there's a gold rush, the ones that really make the money are the ones selling the equipment for the gold rush, right? So that is why we have infrastructure plays so much in mind, because we want to find those companies that are gonna be selling the shovels and the equipment and everything else for the gold rush. So the gaming industry has more than $81 billion spent on purchases and in-game assets alone. So that needs to change as we know it today, right? So who's going to provide the infrastructure for that? We believe it's loot safe. Employment, it's a multi-billion dollar industry worldwide. As we know it today, is extremely cumbersome. Who's going to change that? You know, who's going to provide the infrastructure for that change? We believe it's Emparta. So that is the kind of companies that we like to invest in. You know, hopefully we hope to see our return in those companies. But most importantly, we believe that those companies can also, through their technology, can provide a better tomorrow for us, for humanity.
Yeah, it takes a certain degree of big thinking, you know, to look at that. So like, take an example, not blockchain, Netflix. Okay. You couldn't have looked at Netflix when Netflix first started, which would have been in the early 2000s, if not late 90s. Mm-hmm. I don't remember the exact year. And they were shipping DVDs out, right? And this was a thing where it was not a major streaming media kind of play at the time. That wasn't even like streaming video. Was very, very limited in its applications. I was still on dial-up when Netflix came around. Mm-hmm. But the people who got involved early on and put the money in, I mean, do you think they saw that far ahead? Or do you think it was like, hey, this is just something worth trying out? And is that kind of how you're looking at these things too, what they could become?
Yeah, what they could become is very important, right? But also solving a real problem in the real economy, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so Netflix, for instance, solved the problem of having to spend too much time and resources, and then, you know, the video club that was on the next corner charging you whatever they wanted, right? So there was a lack of competition in the market. There was a lack of logistics in the market. There was a lack of choice in the market, and there was a lack of proper distribution. So they saw that problem, and they thought, well, we're going to try to fix it. And, you know, what else better than do it digitally? I think we live in societies that as they evolve, everything becomes more and more digital. So, you know, as long as you can find the real struggles in the real economy and, you know, fix them. And if it's in a digital way, you know, through good technology, even better. I think those are plays that, you know, they have a reason for existence, right? Making gaming better and more easily to transact and to transition from place to place, it's a need. Changing the way that we get employed and all of that paperwork and things that are cumbersome, you know, that's another real struggle, right? So if we can fix those problems, we are making the world better at the same time that we're creating viable enterprises.
Sure. It's definitely pretty cool to watch happen, because as things went digital and you had these assets become digital, or these, say, employee records, I mean, who owns those? So in one way, you solve a problem and the solution causes new problems that need attention. You take the kind of media content, say it's in the form of a movie or a TV show series, and you make that digital, and now you have the problems of piracy that never existed that way before. There was bootleg tapes, but it wasn't the same, right? So now you're seeing with things like Loot Safe, you can tie in royalties, ownership, it's all trackable, and in a way solve one of those initial problems that was created by downloading and streaming things online. What I find interesting, I read the Loot Safe white paper a while back, from the perspective of not just the developers internal to the teams that make the games and the publishers, but from the people in the mod communities, people that do mods or levels for those kinds of games, that gives them a pathway to kind of paid crowdsourcing. You know, it's fascinating the economies that can arise out of this sort of technology. Speaking of those economies and the mechanics and the economics of tokens, let's just dive into that now, because it would be fascinating to hear your take on that and how that's an emphasis for Gaudium.
Yeah, let's do it. So when we look, so not all the projects that we participate are blockchain, like I said before, and even less, like some of those don't even have a token. But token economies are very, very important. How do you design those token economies? It's even more essential. So let me give you a couple of examples.
Okay.
Some of the projects that you see today in CoinMarketCap, and again, these are like pure cryptocurrency projects, tokenized projects, you know, those, some have very good token economies, which will hopefully, if everything goes well and there's demand for their services, the value of their token will appreciate. But some of them have very flawed design in their token economies and mechanics, which means that even if their services are in very, very high demand, the value of their token is going to converge to zero. And there's many reasons whereby this can happen. One of them is what's called the velocity problem. So the average network value equals the total transaction volume divided by velocity. So if in certain economies that are flawed, if you increase velocity a lot, because it's the denominator of that equation, the average network value is going to go down. So you need to design the economy in ways where that velocity doesn't increase too much. And if it increases in a way that people don't dump your tokens for fiat immediately. So let me give you a very simple example.
Okay.
Again, there's already existing projects that have raised multi-million dollars rounds. And their token economics and mechanics are flawed. So I expect those in the next 10 years to be worth nothing, even though you know, they can have a ton of demand. So to give you a clear example, let's say that you and I start a company that, you know, it's basically to purchase tickets for the theater. It's a perfect utilization for blockchain technology because, you know, it's more transparent. No one can duplicate the tickets. You can control the market of reselling of the tickets and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. However, if the design of your economy is not good enough and all you do is to introduce a token, so people need to change their money into the token, then buy the ticket. You know, the ticket, the person who has sold the ticket is holding tokens, right? Mm-hmm. Immediately, if there's no reason for that person to hold the tokens, it's going to exchange them into fiat, right?
Right.
Because they need to pay wages, they need to pay taxes. You know, they have certain necessities that they need to accomplish.
Right.
So if the mechanisms designed in, you know, in that economy are flawed, you know, people are going to go immediately, different participants are going to go immediately and exchange the token for fiat, you know, whether that's euros, Japanese yens, US dollars or whatever it is, right? Mm-hmm. So if the whole world is buying tickets from the company that you and I just created, it doesn't matter. The value of the token is not going to go up because everyone is going to be dumping them for fiat, right?
Yeah.
However, if we create the right mechanisms to incentivize people to keep those tokens and use those tokens, and by the use of those tokens, they're gaining a utility, then people are going to want more and more of those tokens. So then we have a fantastic paradigm whereby people are not only wanting more tokens, but also demand is increasing for our services. So that is how things should be done. So in short, if you're gonna run a multi-million dollar business or you're gonna create a multi-million dollar business, you might as well have solid fundamentals. Because right now we can see projects that had an amazing team, an amazing value proposition. They were solving fantastic problems, but they just decided to introduce a token in the economy. Sometimes where that token is not even necessary.
Right.
And sometimes even if it's necessary, they introduced it in the wrong way. So, you know, then the value of the token, as they receive more and more demand, the velocity is going to increase and it's going to converge to zero. So that is why that is important. Now, Gaudium understands the fundamentals. So when we look at a project that is crypto and has their own token, we look very deep into those token mechanics and economics. With that said, we typically rely on experts when it comes to the long deep dive, if it's a substantial investment, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I won't touch too much into it, but I would recommend experts on the field, such as Block Method.
Mm-hmm.
So you can search blockmethod.io. Those guys are experts in that, right? Like they live and breathe token mechanics and economics, and they can design amazing economies for those tokens. So
okay.
I would encourage everyone, you know, to have an expenditure early on that is going to be nothing compared with having a very successful business that, you know, for being flawed in design, converges to zero. I don't know if we want to spend more time in that question, but if we have a couple more minutes, I would also like to provide a recommendation in that regard.
Absolutely. And just to quickly recap for those of you that are listening, it's blockmethod.io, and I will include the link in the show notes.
Yep. Perfect.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead and tell us then about that recommendation? We'd really appreciate that.
Yeah. So for people who are willing to build businesses around cryptocurrencies and they're thinking about incorporating their own tokens, I believe that they have two options, or at least I would suggest two options. The first one is looking and going to people such as Block Method, you know, for professional advice and design of all of those intricacies. The second one is to start with a stablecoin. The reason being, if you start with your own token, right, and you have more speculators than users, you're never going to achieve scalability. However, if you start with a stablecoin, you can have, you know, gateways into crypto, and you can be using crypto all day long into any crypto coin that you want, just with parity with a stablecoin. You can maintain the parity of your prices. You have no problem when paying wages and taxes and so on and so forth. And then you will reach a point that if your business is doing well, you will have way more users than speculators, hence having achieved stability. That is what we call an equilibrium point. And at that point, you know, that you have reached by using a stablecoin, then it would make sense to introduce your own token.
Mm-hmm.
Because now you have more users than speculators. And the price of the token is not going to have such wild fluctuations.
Right. Okay. So if I understand correctly, what you're talking about is how to achieve this within the context of actually having a successful utility token, a token that's going mm-hmm. to be used for something other than speculation, and where a lot of people have used the utility token descriptor as a way of backpedaling out of trouble with the SEC or similar organizations because they marketed their thing as a security, at least in the eyes of the SEC. So I'm curious, as far as your take on that and tokenized securities, whether it's STOs or, you know, digital asset issuance, digital security offering, where do you see that in the ecosystem where you still have utility tokens and they still need to be balanced from an economic and technical perspective? Does that also mm-hmm. apply to these STO type projects or assets?
Yeah, well, the STO is a little bit of a different animal. I would like to first, you know, complement something that you have already mentioned, which is, you know, in the US, we have more than 100 years of securities law, mm-hmm. and those should need to be paid attention to. They are there for a reason. With that said, you know, not all jurisdictions are the same. Like if you are in Malta, Switzerland, etc., those mm-hmm. jurisdictions are different. So definitely having legal counsel and making sure that one is 100% compliant is very important. When it comes to STOs versus traditional ICOs, I see them as two different vehicles, right? It depends on which kind of animal do you have.
Right.
If I have a service or an issuance that I am giving the holders of that token royalties, dividends, shares in my company, or things like of that nature, then that is clearly, at least in US framework, a security. Mm-hmm. So, you know, an STO is the way to go in that regard. If you so want to have a token, maybe you don't want to have a token and you can have a regular security issuance.
Mm-hmm.
If what you're doing is you are providing, and again, this is not legal advice. If what you're doing is you're providing a utility to the users to use your platform and to gain benefits from your platform, such as reward programs or things of that nature, or then you have a case for utility. And, you know, granting that you have a good network effect, some users already using that, and some other things. So I think those are two different kinds of projects, right? Like the ones that you clearly are the traditional way that offer dividends, royalties, and so on and so forth. And the other projects that, you know, they intend to create good for humanity. And hopefully if you back them up, you're going to receive the benefits of it. But by no means they're guaranteeing you returns, or they're not guaranteeing you royalties or dividends or so.
Right.
Those I see that it's very beautiful when the community comes together, supports one of those projects that they believe in, and they raise money through an ICO. I think that is very beautiful. And also, you know, in like I said, in some jurisdictions, the framework is extremely friendly to do so and highly encouraged.
Sure.
So I see both of them making progress. Not necessarily one more than the other one. I mean, the securities market eventually would, I think it will be tokenized, and that's trillions of dollars mm-hmm. that will be tokenized. There's also room for the ICOs, because you will always have those projects that are more mostly backed by the community and they want to create something different and they all chime in and then they reap the benefits of that.
Right.
So I think they both can and should coexist. When it comes to security tokens, the advantages are clear to me. You know, it provides way higher liquidity. It provides way higher transparency. It provides fractionalization of ownership. You typically have higher returns, all else equal, because you have cut the middleman from the story. And then you have, hopefully, 24/7 in an international market to trade those tokens. You also have way lower transaction costs. So if I am to own a piece of real estate in a traditional way or in a security tokenized way, you know, provided that the infrastructure gets there, which I don't think we're there yet, but that's something that we can touch on later. Provided that we are 5 years from now and the infrastructure is there, I'd much rather have my ownership in that piece of real estate through tokens. Because if tomorrow I'm tired of it, you know, I can send them to your wallet and you give me some money in exchange and, you know, everything is done.
Right.
Whereas if we want to do it today, we need to engage in an average of 3 month lengthy process with a lot of lawyers, a lot of intermediaries that are going to take a piece of the pie. And it's very cumbersome. And, you know, if tomorrow you want to sell them to someone in China, it's going to be even more difficult. Right. But if it's tokenized, it's just a simple transfer from your wallet to their wallet. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, this is something I definitely agree where from what I'm gathering in these interviews I've been doing and, you know, the reading I've been able to do, it's not really that it's an STO versus ICO thing. I don't know. I keep seeing these debates, these articles that put the two against each other. It's this sort of false duality where an STO or a digital securities offering, however you like to call it, is a technological evolution of securities, of, you know, assets being dealt with that way, where an ICO is the form it's taking now that everything's kind of settling into place with that, is essentially it's a technological evolution of Kickstarter, of crowdfunding. And crowdfunding was fundamentally about, hey, I like that project. I want that movie to get made. I want this new version of the game to be created. I like this idea. I'm going to put some money into it just to get the product. And now they can actually be sure of it, because people forget that the way that crowdfunding has existed prior to now actually had a lot of flaws. I mean, it kind of sucked. There were a lot of articles years back saying, hey, you know, how many of these Kickstarters or Indiegogo, GoFundMe, how many actually get done versus hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars that just disappear. It's an interesting adaptation, and they're not necessarily in competition now that people are getting clear about their purposes.
Yeah, I think your analogies are spot on. I think you have illustrated, you know, in a very eloquent and an elegant way. I wish I had come up with that example myself.
Well, I appreciate that you're taking the time to explain the economics aspect of these utility tokens or these examples where they're going to play out, because the way I see it now, you take Bitcoin, for instance, as one of the first use cases, okay? And it was very successful in a way. And that's an ideologically, philosophically driven project in response to the banking situation and the economic consequences of that in 2008, 2009. We're now, with this technology, able to run really fast philosophical and conceptual experiments through economics. I mean, for a long time, it was people with different economic school of thought kind of arguing with each other through long books and debate societies. And now we can play out economic theories very quickly and iterate them very quickly online. So you said you have a background in economic stuff. I mean, where do you see that being most fascinating? Things like loot safe, things like what?
Yeah, I think that being fascinating in the sense that, you know, Bitcoin is just a scratch of what the technology of blockchain can do. It was a wonderful, beautiful proof of concept, in my opinion. But that is like if we have a table and we just do a tiny little scratch. You know, we can totally redo pretty much everything as we know it, as long as that needs what blockchain can provide, which is basically trimming down intermediaries, providing greater transparency, providing an immutable ledger, so there's a source of truth. And then also the aspect that you very well put before, which is people coming together to create beautiful projects that can have an impact in the well-being of humanity. That wasn't able to be done before, let's say 20 years ago. Like, how would you do that 20 years ago? I think it was totally impossible, right? But yeah. Today we have these vehicles that allow for that to happen. And very honestly, if a group of people get together, they put all of that effort and all of, sweat, earned capital or whatever it is, or their time and their work and everything, and they create something that then humanity benefits from. I mean, I perfectly see fair that the value of their token, increases. Those people have put, everything they had into that cause. So, and they have made the world a better place. Why wouldn't they get rewarded for it, right?
Right.
In such a simple way as A, being able to enjoy that platform before anyone else, B, being early adopters and innovators, and C, having a token that increases in value if there's high demand for that.
Right.
To me, it makes perfect sense.
It's definitely cool to see, focus just on the potential of what can be done from an altruistic or at least a portion of altruism in there, a healthy portion. The name for this is slipping my mind. There's a term for an artist or somebody, in the Renaissance era, they would have a family, a wealthy family, a powerful group that would, it's not sponsor. It's slipping my mind, but essentially because their work was viewed as important or fundamentally valuable or beautiful, these wealthy families would just give them money to do it. And that was just seen as a net benefit for not only their own name and their reputation, but just for society. I think there's a lot of opportunity to see that sort of thing, crowdsourced art, funding, sponsorship for events, conferences, charity. There's a lot of potential there.
Yeah, let me give you one quick example that Andreas Antonopoulos mentioned the other day, and I thought it was fascinating. So today we have disasters such as hurricanes, and the disaster relief oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes comes late and evenly distributed, and it's pretty cumbersome.
Yeah.
So let's say that a group of people that are brilliantly technologically educated, they come together and they code an autonomous entity, which means it has, it cannot be influenced by anyone. It's just a piece of code that is going to detect, connected through different databases, when a hurricane happens and in which geography has it happened. So let's say it triggers the alarm that the hurricane has happened in Miami. That is corroborated by all the databases. And then, it looks at the GPS signals in Miami, and it distributes a certain amount of money to each of those GPS signals, right? That could be thought of as a nonprofit autonomous entity that is going to have a very objective view of reality, that is going to be very transparent because everyone can see the code and see how that, autonomous entity operates and how it distributes the money and which criteria does it use and so on and so forth. So, people would have the choice of donating money to an autonomous entity that know perfectly what that autonomous entity is going to do, how it's going to do it, and when it's going to do it, versus giving the money to a nonprofit organization that is full of intermediaries. And, you don't even know where the money is going to go, how it's going to be used, when it's going to be used. Is it even going to, what portion of it is actually going to end up helping the actual disaster relief, right?
Yeah.
So today we have all of the technology and the human resources to start creating those autonomous entities And, you know, they can be, the way that they work is it can either be through a token, but the token is the perfect vehicle and the blockchain is the technology that delivers that and makes that happen. So the moment that we achieve to incorporate oracles into certain blockchains, that can become a reality 5 years from now, if not sooner.
Yeah, that's a fascinating and really inspiring concept, that the resources for aid and disaster relief could actually be tracked down to the bottle of water, down to the purification tablet, and everybody would know exactly what happened. Especially if you get suppliers connected to that system, you could theoretically, and this is you know, being a bit of a dreamer, but you could reverse the price gouging and actually get them to undercut each other on price in an automated system distributing that stuff, which, you know, I've got a lot of friends in the Philippines, and there's already skepticism about the allocation of aid, relief funds, things like that, and certain major NGOs, which I will not name because I like to live, they don't have a great reputation, particularly in the places where there have been some really, really horrible disasters. And there was a typhoon in Haiyan in the Philippines, I think 5 years ago now, maybe 3 or 4 years ago. That was a mess. They've found since then, this has been a controversial thing, like huge, huge deposits of all these supplies that never got distributed, and it's just in warehouses, you know. It's crazy.
Yeah. So there's a better way to do it, and you know, certain technologies are going to enable that.
Yeah.
Like everything in this life, something can be used for good or can be used for bad.
Right.
But the bad uses don't justify shutting down the good uses.
Right. And that factors in, of course, to where you're going to put your focus. And knowing that we only have so much time in a day to spend on things, you have to generally partner with people that you feel are coming from the same place, they have the same values, and that you have a close enough shared vision of the future that you can operate still independently, but toward that same goal. And that's a huge priority for us. I mean, Pendulum Insight, we obviously focus on partnership development, and it seems that you share that value as well. So which kind of partnerships do you see being most valuable to you in the near future?
Yeah, so when it comes to Gaudium in particular, I think that the most valuable partnerships that we're trying to establish right now is companies that are of a similar profile to Gaudium, but that they are located in different parts of the world. That way we can help each other, not only when it comes to subject matter expertise and human capital, but also when it comes to exchanging deal flow between each other. A startup can be great in Barcelona, it can be great in Cape Town, it can be great in the Philippines, it can be great anywhere in the US, right? So, like I said before, we are geography agnostic when it comes to that, and having partners that bring the profile of those companies, wherever they are in the world, is very important for us.
Yeah.
The second one is finding. So Gaudium is a very boutique investment firm, which means we're not a fund. We have a series of capital partners, and those capital partners, they need to align with our values, which is we are the opposite of predators. We like to contribute value to the startups that we invest in and provide them with good terms. Because if we can evaluate them early on, which, by the way, it's totally outside of what we believe is right. But even if we did, you know, then you find yourself that you have crippled the future of that company.
Right.
And so, you know, later investors, even if the business proposition is amazing, even if the startup is amazing, they're going to look at the early investors and say, well, they already took most of the pie, you know, and that is not fair for anyone. And you have already cannibalized your own investment. So that's one. Number two is, like I said before, we're all in this life for a limited period of time, and we never know when that's going to end too. So we might as well make the most of it, right? If someone has spent their life, their effort, and their capital trying to make a venture successful and trying to make the world a better place, hopefully they get rewarded for it. So, you know, the spread and the split, it needs to be proportional and it needs to be fair. You know, one of the things that we help a lot at Gaudium is to the startups that we provide advice to is when the capitalization table is getting formed, you know, to avoid those predator investors and to avoid tricky clauses that then, you know, you liquidate your company for multi-million dollars and to your surprise, everything goes to the investors and nothing to the entrepreneurs. That is not a fair case and we see that all day long. So having good advice when it comes on how to have those investor relations, how to get the right investors, how to get, you know, a clean capitalization table that is going to enable you to have successful rounds in the future, that is of the utmost importance. So to summarize that, we focus on people most and foremost. We like to work with people that have a high degree of ethics, and sometimes a handshake goes, you know, goes to the end of the world. So that's what we like to do. In that regard, you know, I would also like to hear what your take is on Pendulum Insights, because for what I know up until now, you know, you guys specialize in finding key partnerships, creating solid relationships, and providing that, going the extra mile to put people in touch, you know, when, you know, entity A has this need and entity B is looking to fulfill that need.
Yeah, and I appreciate the question. We have a similar emphasis on the integrity aspect. You know, we came into this space relatively recently. I have been interested in and involved with just the use of an observation of Bitcoin and related things like Litecoin. I want to say it was 2013, around there. Kind of kept an eye on it, but didn't really take great notice until all of the hype of last fall. So the 2017 late fall and winter. And that to me was kind of disappointing. You know, I thought, well, this is great that people are making some money, but anytime I see hype on that level and that scale, I get a little bit worried, you know, and I had people that had never, ever, ever taken an interest in it years ago when I mentioned it. And I'm going to sound like a hipster now, but bear with me. They're suddenly telling me like, hey, have you heard of this? You should be putting your money into this. You should invest in this. Like, oh no, my friends, these people are going to lose their money. So, you know, nonetheless, things started to get really fascinating though. Once I had discovered the concept of a smart contract, like, well, wait a minute. People are starting business purposes beyond just the currency. Don't get me wrong, cryptocurrency is fascinating by itself, but I took a closer look. I'd been helping people buy and sell online businesses, and it occurred to me, well, hey, you could tokenize that kind of asset. You could make a fund. You could do this and that. Started interviewing people, and I realized that this space has a lot of partnership development activity in it, and I would not need to necessarily educate people on the benefits of partnering with other companies, where in some industries it's kind of new, like what's a joint venture, why would I want to do that? However, a lot of them, my understanding is a kind of surface level, and they might promote a little bit, like slap each other's logos on the sites, but they don't really dig deeper than that. Or they're tech partnerships, so they use something from that person's tech stack and they just kind of integrate that way. But the depth of service integration or understanding of each other's user base or clients isn't always there. And the other thing was, as you mentioned, there are a lot of predatory financial interests and there are a lot of really fly-by-night marketing operations and media operations. So where my focus is right now is identifying consulting and advisory firms that are actually based in integrity and have values and a view for the long term, and they're not just there to take money out of a hype bubble. And then people who are coming in from the capital side that actually also have a long-term interest and a fundamentally shared vision for either the people they're working with or for the kind of potential of integrating blockchain technology, or even, as you mentioned earlier, the things like AI and machine learning and all of that. It's actually the way that I view trends. They're not independent. They're coexisting, evolving. That emphasis then on finding the trustworthy, valuable, and long-term focused media partners, capital partners, and the opportunities with the actual companies themselves, who they're able to get service integrations by partnering with other companies at the same level or maybe a little bigger than them. That's been a major thing. I know that I'm all over the place, but the core thing there is that do they have a long-term shared set of values and a vision?
That's right. No, I think that's very cool, Colton, because you know a good partnership can make a whole world of a difference, right? Yeah. To help you into expand your business or get that key thing that you needed covered, and so on and so forth. And you know, right now we see two different views of business. The old legacy business, they focus on competition, mm-hmm. and the new businesses that focus on cooperation. Mm-hmm. And cooperation is everything. You know, it's demonstrated through research and through history too, that by cooperating, you go way farther than by competing. So, you know, having the help of a company like yours that helps you with establishing that synergies of cooperation and partnerships that can be a game changer, I think that's of the essence.
Yeah, I appreciate that because we really fundamentally believe that alliances and strong, well-thought-out alliances between sovereign-minded individuals and technologically evolving organizations, whether that's governments or enterprises, that is the most ethical and effective framework upon which we can build this sort of new society that's happening anyway. And we can either let it continue to get chaotic and disorganized and kind of predatory, or we can do something where we're actually able to put real economic force behind organized focus and productive activities. So it's mm-hmm. good to find people like yourself who are out there helping these startups and these early stage companies find the right capital partners, and rather than losing everything that they've got without even knowing it because of some little clause that they didn't understand. So in your experience, what should be the number one priority for a startup seeking seed capital from firms like those that you're working with? I know you touched on this earlier, but just in summary, the number one priority for them.
So the number one priority for them should be to have all of their ducks in a row. You know, a lot of startups go out there to raise money, but they don't have cleanup materials, or they don't have their story in order. They don't have their financials in order. If they are a token startup, sometimes they don't have their token design in order, and so on and so forth, right? So the first thing would be to have your ducks in a row, which it comes as a basic, but you know, it's sometimes lacking. The second one would be you need to solve a real world problem. And that also comes as a cliche, but you know, we see things that are more of a luxury or more of a want rather than a need. The ones that really make it to the long term are the ones that cover a need, not a want. Mm. So that's the second one. And then the third, you know, again, be careful who you partner with, because not all money is created equal. Mm. And sometimes, you know, certain people might lure you with a big, nice check, but the conditions that come attached to it, they're not, you know, they're the ones that are going to cripple the rest of your future. So, you know, hopefully you can get a good, nice check, but also that comes with good conditions. And also it varies a lot from a capital partner that is involved and helps you to the one that is not involved at all, doesn't help you. And on top of that is on top of you, you know, like micromanaging you. Like our approach at Gaudium is the opposite, right? Like if we invest in someone, we want that someone to succeed. And we believe that someone, group of people, or, you know, they are way better at what they do than any of us at Gaudium. That's why we're investing in them, right? So who are we to go and tell them what to do? You know, we can provide advice. We can provide coaching in certain areas. You know, if they need help and if they request the help, if they don't need it, you know, let it be. And also, like I said, with the terms, like we try to provide terms that are going to encourage future investors to come in. You know, and we're going to help with that as much as we can, because it goes for the benefit of everyone.
That's good. You know, it gets me thinking, some of the conversations I've had lately, and this one as well, that if they're very technical guys, so you've got a great team, they've got a great vision, they're very brilliant, just excellent programmers, you know, minds for math, but they do not have experience with fundraising. There's, as you said, there's predatory elements out there. And I think this particular space, more than any in a long time, is a kind of a breeding ground and a fresh, bloody bait for the smoothest white-collar criminals in the world. Not to mention the kind of marketing scammers that everybody's talked about, but I mean some really seriously shrewd bastards. How can they detect that early on? I mean, whether they're working with somebody like you or they're out there on their own, what's a red flag they should always look out for?
Yeah, so I mean, there's always things that can be done. I think one of them is have a good array of advisors that know more than you do in certain areas, right? So if you have a very, very technical team, maybe you need an advisor that knows very, very well how to go to market. If you are not good in people relationships and you're not good at pitching, et cetera, maybe you need an advisor that can coach you on investor relations and the materials that you need done, and so on and so forth. So here is where Gaudium also helps in their part of advisory services. Again, not anyone can hire Gaudium to get their advisory services. We're very picky and they need to fit a profile. But the ones that do fit the bill, that's what we try to do, right? Is first of all, tell us what you need help with, you know, because the ones that you don't need help with, we don't want to be a blocker or a barrier or even influence that, right? Like if you're probably way better than us in certain areas, so take care of those. But even the ones that you need the help, you know, maybe it's capitalization tables, maybe it is investor relations, maybe it's go-to-market strategy, then those are the areas that we focus and we try to bring value and we try to help cover those needs. And it makes the world of a difference, you know, from going from one way to another one. Like, I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't because a lot of people helped me on my way. And obviously those were people that they knew better than I knew how to do certain other things that I didn't know how to do. So the way that I think about it, you know, for instance, Gaudium too, we rather invest in a company that is seeking the right help rather than a company that thinks that they can do everything on their own and do it better than anyone else. I don't think that those kind of teams exist. You know, I think it's just not, it's utopia. So if we find a company that is very well versed and has nice advisors, they have, you know, they're bad at marketing, so they have a good PR firm, they're bad at, you know, I don't know, finances, so they have a financial advisor firm or whatever it is. Right. You know, we very much like those because we recognize, oh, those people are very good at the technical part. They spend 100% of their time doing what they're good at doing. And then they let, you know, the other ones that are good at something else do the other things. And then it's the perfect combination.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you're listening to this now and you're on the side where you're a founder or you're on a team and you're actually developing your product, don't try to do all of it. You know, in my time helping people buy and sell these online businesses, I can say that a good number of them, unless they were just doing an e-commerce thing and they knew that's what it was, but a good number of people came across my inbox, so to speak, that thought they had the next Facebook or the next Salesforce, and it ended up going for $50,000, $60,000, $100,000 to somebody who just wanted to grab the email list and some of the development they'd done. And they always insist, no, this is worth millions of dollars. Like, well, it might have been if you had gone and gotten some advisors a long time ago and actually had a path toward that. They didn't understand the business side and they didn't want to take any help or any advice. And so 2-3 years of the life of them and all their teammates, they got about $100,000 to split between a few people. You don't want to end up in that boat. So take the advice, get your ducks in a row, get yourself advisors that allow you to focus on that product and focus on your vision so they can handle all the things that are necessary for you to even become, you know, a $20 million business, which would still be tiny in the world that we're talking about, but nonetheless a success.
Yeah, I mean, those examples are very good, Colton. And also, you know, I imagine that Pendulum Insights has advisors, and so does Gaudium Capital. Gaudium Capital has their own advisors, because someone who has raised four funds, mm-hmm. you know, they might not be focused on small companies, but they definitely know how to invest.
Yeah.
You know, and they have a lot of things that we can learn from, and a lot of advice that we can get from them as well. So we definitely have our own advisors as well.
Yeah, you absolutely have to. You know, there are things that I'm good at, and there's a lot that I'm not good at. And I wasted a lot of time trying to do everything myself. So, you know, what I want to do now is shift into my personal favorite part of the whole show, which is your favorite deal story. So just some okay. kind of something good, something juicy that we can learn from.
Yeah. Let me think about it for a second.
Sure.
Okay, I think at the end of the day, the good deal stories are the ones that both parties are thrilled mm-hmm. when you sign the dotted line. I think that's the utmost important thing. To give you an example, you know, when I was in business school, little did we knew about this, but by sharing our information, we could cut way better deals than if we didn't share our information, right? Mm-hmm. So once I learned that, you know, I always entered into a negotiation saying like, look, I'm not going to hide it. This is what I can offer. This is what are my needs. Mm-hmm. If you tell me what you can offer and you tell me what are your needs, then we can try to make it work in a way that we maximize both of us. Mm-hmm. Because you might as well need something that it's of very little cost to me and it's of great value to you, and the other way around. So if you tell me what you have and what you need, and I tell you what I have and what I need, we can sit together in the same table, spend as much time as necessary until we reach a solution that you maximize everything that you need and I maximize everything that I need. And those deals happen. And then they happen also in the real world, because then once you've learned that, you apply it into any, pretty much any negotiation that you go to, right? And if the other person is reasonable and you know, and you can trust them, it's the perfect way to do it, because you save a lot of time. You know, they tell you what they need and what they can offer. You tell them what you need and what you can offer. Being transparent, you try to maximize it. And oftentimes you see that after the handshake and after signing the dotted line, both parties are thrilled. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, it's my favorite kind of story, because two parties that are thrilled in making a deal, they're going to work and they're going to work on that deal, like with a lot of enthusiasm and, you know, with the best that they have. Whereas if you, one of the two sides of the deal, you know, it's things that it's being taken advantage of or things that, you know, oh, those are not good terms. I just took them because I had to. Mm. You know, that part of the party is not going to perform as expected, or at least is not going to perform to the maximum that they can offer, right? And I personally like to engage in business with people that are motivated, that have interests that are aligned, and that we can offer each other, you know, things that we're going to be thrilled about achieving together.
Yeah, excellent. So, you know, the way I understand that then is you think that a deal-making process, it does not need to be a game or a battle in which there's a winner or a loser, and it doesn't need to be even looked at that way. It can be a collaborative, creative process where you're partnering with them to reach a solution.
And absolutely.
That's something that is, of course, a beautiful outcome, and it never feels good to be stuck in a deal that you didn't get necessarily what you'd like to get out of it. Maybe the other person didn't either. And just because you have a contract in place and you can legally enforce it does not mean that you're going to get the best outcome for either side, because nobody likes to do anything they're forced to do and they're not going to do it well. They'll just do bare minimum to legally comply if they don't want to go to court. And that's basically everybody losing.
That's exactly right. And you are not going to be creating a long-term relationship. It's gonna last for, you know, the minimum that it needs to last. And you want the opposite. You want long-lasting relationships in which you have created value, and they can persist through a lifetime.
Yeah. And, you know, this is a relatively young technology, and the people that are gravitating toward it are fascinating, brilliant people, but it's a small world and it's only getting smaller. So your reputation matters too, as much as the outcome of any deal on the bottom line. You have to concern yourself with your long-term reputation.
Absolutely. And your partnerships matter in the same way. You want to be associated with really nice partnerships, and having someone that helps you develop the right quality of those partnerships is of the utmost importance.
Absolutely. Any final words of wisdom that you'd like to share with everybody who's listening right now?
No, I think, you know, the only final words of wisdom is, which I don't even think in their words of wisdom, is pretty much something that we all should live by, is trying to do everything as good as we can. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, in my opinion, this life is short-lived. So if we can create value, if we can create good relationships, if we can make a difference, whether it's by implementing tech, providing a better service, or something like that that can influence the life of people, that is a life worth living, right? Like, I think there's no point in going to the graveyard rich, but having left a legacy of bad things.
Yeah.
You know, like that is not, I think you will have a ton of remorse at the very end. and it's probably nothing would have been worth it. Whereas if you know that you go having left the place better than you found it, with people that will remember how nice it was either to do business with you or to work with you or to have a beer with you or something like that, or that you helped them and they helped you and you could give them a phone call at any point in time, that is a life worth living, right? And creating meaningful enterprises, businesses that can help us achieving those goals, I think that's a life worth living.
Absolutely. And I appreciate that insight. You know, I like to think that a deal is only as good as the people you're dealing with. And so you need to be a good person to deal with. Step one. Mm-hmm. Where can our listeners connect with you if they're interested in learning more about how you and Gaudium can help them, or how they can help you?
Yeah. That's great. I would very much like to hear and connect with any startups, that are interested in partnering with Gaudium, or with any capital sources that would be interested in discussing business with Gaudium as well. They all can go to our website, which is gaudiumcapital.com. Hopefully you can put the link below. Mm-hmm. And there, if they go to services, there's the three different sections, and they can fill out one of the contact forms, or they can directly go to the contact section and shoot us an email, and we will reply as soon as we can.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Alvaro Jimenez, GaudiumCapital.com, everybody. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much for your time, and it's a pleasure to be in touch with Pendulum Insights.
And you as well. Thank you for listening to the Pendulum Insight podcast. If you learned something today and you want to know more, go check out PendulumInsight.com.